This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 195. Today we speak about theologizing in today's connected culture. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 195. My name is Camden Busey, and I am back in the studio. I recently sat down with Jared Oliphant, who is regional coordinator for Westminster Theological Seminary, to discuss a number of topics, including the dynamics of theologizing in today's connected society. And we'll get to that conversation in just a minute. We have been very busy with many things this summer, and I'm very pleased to announce again that Reformed Forum has been recognized by the IRS as a 501c3 organization. This means that your donations are tax deductible to the fullest extent of the law. This designation has already opened up many new doors for us, and we're very excited about all of the opportunities for Reformed Forum ahead in the coming weeks and months. And so if you would be able and are interested in donating and helping us to continue to produce and distribute all sorts of Reformed theological content, please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. If you'd like to be updated about news like this in the future. I know some of our recordings get a little behind because we record ahead of time, but if you'd like to stay updated in a way that you'll make sure that it gets to your inbox and that you'll be able to hear about news such as this, please subscribe to our email list. Just visit reformedforum.org and enter your email address in the form on the middle of the page. We send monthly newsletters that contain important news such as this 501c3 designation, and we send out all sorts of other updates and things in that monthly newsletter. So subscribe to the email list today and make sure that you are updated and fully informed about what we're doing here at Reformed Forum. Now, we will be back to our regular interview schedule in the fall season. We're working on scheduling those interviews now. So pay attention to your podcast client and also to the website, reformedforum.org, for all the new episodes coming out each Friday. But until then, we have another just great, casual, friendly discussion between Jared Oliphant and I. And so now let's tune in and listen to that. Now to today's discussion. We have a lot of conferences coming up. This is the fall season. And there's a lot of stuff going on. I know you, with your job, you're going to have to be at many of these. What ones are you looking forward to, and what's coming up on the calendar?
Yeah, this will definitely be an interesting fall because I've traveled a lot as when I was director of admissions for Westminster. But part of what I'm going to be doing is trying to get into conferences and events that Westminster typically hasn't been at before, or even trying to check out new conferences that are coming up. Huh. One that most of our listeners are going to know about is the Desiring God Conference, which either is going on now or it's September 22nd.
Westminster hasn't gone to that before?
Not that I know of.
Recently?
I don't think so. I mean, I haven't. So
yeah.
Since 2008, we haven't been there. But I'm really looking forward to that, partially because I haven't been to that conference before. I haven't been to Minneapolis before. So I'm looking forward just to seeing the demographic that shows up for this. And the topic is really all about missions. And so obviously Piper is going to be speaking and a few others. I think Dave Harvey is going to be there. So looking forward to that. Jonathan Brack's going to be there, and we're just going to be talking to people and trying to relate the topic of missions to what Westminster does, obviously.
Sure.
But yeah,
Piper is it themed after his book? He has a book called Let the Nations Be Glad.
I know. I'm not sure. I'm sure that's going to play a part in it, without a doubt. I forget the topic that was either last year or the year before, but that's definitely it's well attended.
Right.
We're going to have some advertising there, so really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the bigger ones.
Yeah.
In terms of conservative theological conferences.
Yeah, definitely.
And what are the dates for that?
It is September 22nd to 25th.
Yeah, that might be going on at the time this airs. But
So drive on over to Minneapolis.
Yeah. Well, you might listen to this and maybe they'll be streaming something. Who knows?
That's true. I'm I mean, Desiring God just does a great job with their media. They put a lot of audio up there, a lot of video. They have the live talks that air that they do the video for. So good ministry.
Yeah, I really like their model, and they don't lock things down typically. Right. And, you know, and they make it freely available. It makes it tough sometimes to try to support because they often have to come and they're short on their budget. But there might be other factors in that with the economy and all. But generally speaking, I like the way they go about their website and how they make resources available to everyone. And there's a very low barrier of entry. Mm-hmm. We try to do the same thing at Reform Forum. But
Yeah, that's right. And they have a great range. So Piper can give an hour talk on, mm-hmm. you know, some kind of topic that's out there, but then he can give a 3-minute, hey, here's what's going on this mm-hmm. topic that's also buzzing out there. So mm-hmm. I like that they have flexibility. They can do that.
Yeah, I know they're very intentional about the look and the design of the website. We have some friends that work there and, you know, speaking to them, they're very intentional and they do great work. DesiringGod.org is a great website.
Yeah, definitely.
So if anybody hasn't been there or hasn't been there in a while, go to the website and check it out.
Yeah.
We have some Alliance of Confessing Evangelical conferences. There's 4 regional conferences coming up in the fall here. We covered the Philadelphia Conference on Reformed Theology back in April, and that's an annual conference they do down at 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. And it's a great conference. We had a great time going down there. We're working on partnering with the Alliance to cover as many of these fall conferences as we can. But the conferences are going to be held in Princeton, New Jersey, Bethesda, Maryland, which is right by D.C., and Quakertown, Pennsylvania, and then Charleston, West Virginia. What are the dates and some of the other info on those conferences?
Yeah, the Princeton one that you mentioned is going to be, the title is called How Long, O Lord, Suffering Scripture and the Grace of God, and that's featuring D.A. Carson and Ligon Duncan.
Yeah.
And if you want to put that on your calendar, it's November 4th to 5th.
Uh-huh.
And that should be a good one. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get out there, but we'll definitely be looking for audio. And if you have the opportunity to go, definitely would check that out.
Yeah, we'll be covering that one for sure.
Awesome.
Jeff Waddington and Jim Cassidy, I believe, are going to be going to that one. Hopefully we'll have interviews with these men prior to the conference as well, and then we'll talk to them at the conference. So we it's kind of up in the air now, but we're working out some ways that we can partner with the Alliance and actually cover them live. We won't be streaming the actual discussion. That's their thing. And they,
right.
you know, they release those on their own. But we'll be covering it kind of like a news organization or something. You know, like, you know, like Fox News or something.
On the scene. And,
yeah. Like when they go to the debates or something, they have like uh-huh. a table, you know, in between, or they the pundits.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what we're the pundits.
This. What was the topic of the discussion at the previous?
Well, I really thought he projected confidence in his lecture. I thought the choice of the red tie was appropriate given their message of
hope. Who wore it best?
Yeah,
that segment. Yeah, that'd be excellent. And take it in a different direction.
What about some of the other ACE conferences?
Yeah, the other one I went, just going back to the Princeton one, that's going to be at Nassau Presbyterian Church if you're looking for a location.
Church,
and again,
really
that's at Princeton, so November mm-hmm. 4th to 5th. The one that's literally the next week is going to be, the title is called Our Great God, and that's in Quakertown, Pennsylvania. And the speakers there are going to be Brian Chappell, Kevin DeYoung, Stephen Nichols, and Rick Phillips.
Mm.
So you got a powerhouse of speakers at that one as well. Both of those are just – I'm really glad they're incorporating these guys to speak about these topics. But the dates for that, like I said, is just a week after the one that we previously mentioned. So it's going to be November 11th through 12th.
Yeah.
And that's at Grace Bible Fellowship Church there in Quakertown. So if you're remotely in that area, I know a lot of people from Philly are going to be making the drive up there. It's what, like an hour north or something? It's
relatively it's only 45 close. Minutes to an hour, depends on the time of day. It's really not that bad. It forms a triangle. Philadelphia, Princeton, and Quakertown form roughly an equilateral triangle.
Right.
So it's kind of a strategic thing. I know that people out west or in the Midwest, you know, these are hard to get to. But if you live in the east, they try to spread them out. So there are conferences to go to. So take a look at that.
Yeah, definitely.
The Bethesda, Maryland one?
I don't have that information up. I was looking for it, actually. Hopefully we can
get that. I know Michael Horton
will
be there.
Okay.
I believe it's on the church.
Okay.
Doctrine of the Church.
And you can, they can go to AllianceNet.org.
AllianceNet.org. Right? Yeah. I don't have my computer in front of me, so I apologize to the listeners.
and I didn't see it, so my bad.
Well, AllianceNet.org has all the information. You can find that. And then there's also a conference in Charleston, West Virginia, which should also be a great one.
That's right. Who do you know who's speaking there?
Mm-mm.
I know we're just
harder
kind of
for us to get to.
Going back and forth on ignorance here, but if you want more info.
Unprepared.
Yeah.
There's a lesson in unpreparedness today.
Yeah. Well, one other, just speaking of Kevin DeYoung, who we just mentioned, he's going to be doing the preaching conference at Westminster.
Yeah.
The dates for that, it's going to be at Westminster. It's October 25th through 26th. He's going to be the keynote speaker, and the title for that is called The Cure for the Boring Sermon.
Right.
Which is a good, nice title. So along with Kevin DeYoung, it's going to be Carl Truman, Dave Garner, and John Curry. And they're going to be doing some lectures and some
talks
about preaching.
That is free.
Is it really?
They're free. They're always free. You can come, but you have to register.
Okay.
So the preaching conferences are always free.
I should know that.
So, you know, you can fly out here, you know, save some money because you're not paying to attend. If you're in the area, you know, register and come. It's a great time. And We have Kevin DeYoung booked to do an interview at that time. Jonathan worked something out. So hopefully that holds, and we'll be able to interview him about probably one of his recent books.
Yeah, he just had a book come out on
Mission of the Church.
Mission of the Church. That's
with
right.
Greg Gilbert.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And D.A. Carson, who you mentioned earlier, is going to be at the other one. He's going to be doing the Gaffin Lecture actually in the spring.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, yeah. So some good connections going on with this area.
Wow. D.A. Carson, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
The Gaffin Lecture is a thing that was funded, and I believe it's an annuity that comes every year, and the seminary is able to bring in a visiting scholar to deliver a scholarly lecture in honor of Dr. Gaffin and his work. Mm-hmm. And so last year it was Al Mohler.
Yeah, who we had on here with Dr. Loback.
Bob Lethem did it once. Some other people. D.A. Carson this year. So we'll also let you know when those come up, and so you can come out to Westminster Theological Seminary here in Glenside, Pennsylvania to listen to those lectures as well.
Yeah.
Where else are you traveling? Anything else? The CCEF conference?
Yeah, that one, I am really looking forward to that one.
Yeah.
That's going to be very cool, partially because of the topic and partially just because CCF just does a great job with their conferences. It's a lot of fun going to those things. But this one is going to be October 20th through 22nd, and that's going to be in Louisville.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of conferences in Louisville coming up. The CCF.
Well, the T4G is going to be down there.
T4G,
as well.
And then the PCA General Assembly. All three of those are going to be in Louisville this academic year. But the CCF one is on, we've mentioned it before, it's on psychiatric disorders.
Right.
So it's really the bottom line questions when it comes to medicating psychology and psychiatry. Those are going to be at the fore of the topics that are discussed, which is just CCF's forte. They really can speak to that. So guys like Mike Emlett, who is an actual MD and has prescription background, prescribing background. He's a doctor. He can speak to that. And they're just going to hit it from all angles. So I'm going to be listening to as much as I can there while working. So I'm really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, I really enjoy the CCEF conferences as well. I've been to a few of them. Very helpful, especially for those in pastoral ministry and those who want to seek to help each other in the church, and it also can be helpful in just family situations as well. You know, there are a lot of difficult things going on in families, and there are a lot of challenges when we come to issues of counseling and particularly psychiatric disorders. How do we relate the world of medicine and psychiatry to the world of theology and biblical ministry? And that's something that I believe CCEF is very well equipped to deal with. And they're very difficult questions. So it will be well worth attending the conference or getting your hands on those resources to help you be better equipped to help others in the church, whether you're a minister, an elder, or just a person in the pew that can help somebody else at your church. So it'll be a very worthwhile conference to attend and to listen to.
Yeah. One thing in preparation for that, one of my favorite discussions that I've had on just with Reform Forum is interviewing Pallison when we were at the Coalition. And we just asked him, what's the connection then between biblical counseling and Van Til? And he was just so helpful in laying out the background, because biblical counseling is just such a trend now, in a good way, but a lot of times the worldview and the theology behind it that was Van Til and I think just Calvin and the tradition expressed through and applying it to psychology. He just did such a good job of expressing, here's the background to what biblical counseling is properly applied.
Yeah, this Biblical Counseling Coalition started, mm-hmm. and they had some sessions at the Gospel Coalition Conference to address that. But speaking with Dr. Paulison is always refreshing because he understands very much the philosophical underpinnings and the apologetic bent and the theological prolegomena, the basis on which the CCEF model of counseling runs.
Right.
And they're related. And the model of counseling doesn't work well, and it cannot be divorced from its theological presuppositions and its, you know, the prolegomena.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's a difficult word, but we're talking about doctrines of revelation, doctrine of God, you know, anthropology. All these things are related. If we're going to minister to people in the church, we have to understand we have to have a foundation in solid theology, Reformed theology.
Yeah.
And that's where the connection with Van Til comes in. Because we start to understand who we are. Well, we're covenantal creatures. We're created in the image of God. We are always coram Deo in the face of God. We're either covenant keepers or covenant breakers. God has given us his word in scripture. It's the inspired word of God, and it speaks to us, and it demands a response of obedience. And it also lets us know about our human condition. So these are just some basic ideas to demonstrate why we say biblical counseling needs to be Van Tilian.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Van Til is a convenient figure because of the way he packaged Reformed theology. He's a convenient figure to use as an example for the foundations of biblical counseling.
Yeah, that's
so. If you're not having all those Reformed distinctives, and biblical counseling cannot work.
Right, you can't take it to its logical conclusion. Oh. That's exactly right. Yeah, it can't be consistent. The one book that we'd highly recommend, we've mentioned this before as well, is just The History of the Biblical Counseling Movement by Paulison.
Mm-hmm.
He has so many great illustrations. I mean, Paulison is a guy who has lived this history. What's that?
Like colored pictures?
Yeah, it folds out and scratch and snip. No, he gives colorful examples of and stories that have been relayed to him as well. Like, you know, there were students in the 60s who were literally taking classes from Van Til and talking about theology applied to philosophy and, you know, just on fire for that. And then they would go into another class on counseling.
And it would be
a therapeutic model. And so there was a complete disconnect at that point because the biblical counseling movement hasn't been started at that point. So anyway, just those kinds of things that really flesh out, here's the history behind biblical counseling. Here's the, like you said, theological underpinnings behind biblical counseling.
Yeah. You know, that's something about Van Til and the Theological Encyclopedia. That's like a fancy phrase. It talks about all the disciplines. When we talk about what is taught at a seminary, for instance, or what we learn about when we study theology, we learn systematic theology, we learn biblical theology, we learn biblical studies, New Testament, Old Testament, church history, practical theology. I don't think I'm missing anything. Hopefully not.
Apologetics.
Apologetics. Well, that could be kind of sometimes considered, since we're talking about Van Til, you know, this is the umbrella, I guess. Yeah. So all these things are related. And oddly enough, before Van Til came in and made explicit what was implicit in the tradition,
right,
or perhaps what had been lost in recent decades, he came in and just very plainly brings some common sense to the discussion and say, look, all these disciplines are related. They're all dependent upon God's revelation, and we live in God's world. And so when we talk about a human being created in the image of God and being a covenantal creature, that shouldn't just simply affect systematic theology.
Mm-hmm.
That's necessarily going to affect our hermeneutics, for instance. Should even affect perhaps how we do church history and how we understand the process of historiography and other things like that. But hello, it's going to affect how we minister to other people and how we counsel people as well, because they're human beings. But oddly enough, what you just alluded to was that in the 60s, there were people very much interested in philosophy and applying it to things like art and aesthetics. But yet, counseling was more of a professional endeavor.
Right.
And the secular world or science divorced from God's revelation probably had more to say towards how biblical counseling happened or Christian counseling happened rather than Reformed theology mm-hmm. or apologetics. Mm-hmm. Well, Paulison did his studies at Penn, an Ivy League school, University of Pennsylvania, and he did a PhD in the history of science. So it was a history degree, but he was looking at the history of science, and like you mentioned, he wrote his dissertation on the biblical counseling movement. Mm-hmm. But he is kind of a counseling reformer of a second generation. We talk about Jay Adams, John Bettler, that, mm-hmm. that kind of started CCEF and started that movement several decades ago. But then Paulison, knowing them, working with them, and then carrying it on. But he is just a thorough thinker and a mm-hmm. very rigorous one as well, who understands the theology of Van Til and understands how all these disciplines relate and simply is just applying a consistent Reformed theology to another discipline, biblical counseling and a practical theology. And we can take and apply a thorough Reformed theology to other disciplines as well. That's really what Van Til did. He didn't think he was doing anything tremendously ingenious or new. He's just taking what he knew from good Dutch theology,
right.
You know, Bovink and Vollenhoven and several other guys, Kuyper, Warfield, and just applying it to apologetics and philosophy.
Yeah,
and
just so running Paulison, it to its natural conclusion.
The biblical counseling movement at its best is trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
So we can't just counsel people like the world counsels people because we know more about people.
Exactly.
You know? And what we know, what we've learned from the Bible, what we've learned in our systematic theology classrooms, what we've learned in our apologetic classrooms actually has an impact about how we minister to people, how we one another people, how we help them in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, exactly.
We can't ignore the fact. We can't ignore what we've learned in other classes when we come to the counseling environment.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point.
Yeah.
It sounds pretty basic, but I mean, for years, this was lost on people.
Yeah, exactly. And applying the antithesis as well. So the person that you're counseling.
Yeah, how can I forget that? Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to make a difference what you say, whether that person is a believer or an unbeliever. And so there's no silver bullet counseling model that's going to just run through and ignore that antithesis. Yeah. It's going to be very different when you counsel someone based on their receptivity, whether they have the Spirit, working within their lives to interpret these kinds of things or not. That's mm-hmm. going to be a huge difference for when you want to affect change in somebody.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if we have any other conferences to mention. Do we?
Good.
Because I've got a little topic we can spin off.
Oh, you know what? What I did want to mention is there is a conference that's right around the corner from Westminster.
Oh, yeah.
It is October 7th through 8th, and it's the Summit Conference at Epiphany Fellowship. And I'm unfortunately not going to be able to be there, but just wanted to point you to it if you're in this area. What's that?
Doug Logan, will he be there?
Doug Logan will be there. He's a speaker. Epiphany is pastored by Eric Mason, who some of you might be familiar with. And Anthony Bradley is going to be there speaking as well, among some other people. So if you want more information on that, it's going to be just thriveinthecity.org, or if you just want to Google Summit Conference Epiphany, you'll find more information on that. So that should be another interesting one.
They have a church plant in Camden, New Jersey, too.
That's right. Yeah, the Doug Logan is really heading.
It's a really tough city.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the last one that I wanted to mm-hmm. mention. That should conference them out for a little bit. But it's amazing how these things pop up.
I don't understand why people don't ever have a conference in like June or something. And I realize, there are reasons for this because people don't turn out because they're on vacation or whatever. But man, it makes it tough. October is like a killer.
Oh, I know.
Early November and April are just, especially for someone in your line of work.
Yeah,
I mean, out of control.
On weekends in September and October, there are just, four or five things going on at
you
the same time.
What you're going to do.
Yeah, and I would love to go to all of them, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy how, I mean, I don't know if this is a recent phenomenon or not. I don't have a history with just being in the know on these conferences to know whether this has been the case for the past 10 years or if really in the past like 5 or 6 years, conferencing has just exploded.
Mm-hmm.
At least on my radar, it's exploded, but I don't know if that's accurate to what's going on out there.
Are you guys going to Comic-Con, next Comic-Con?
We are going to be exhibiting there, yeah, in Burning Man. And
you're going to Burning Man.
Yeah. What's the other one that I'm for? The TED.
And then I would you can do some evangelism, like, man, if you don't believe, you're going to be the Burning Man.
Yeah. Make those, yeah, draw a straight line. That's always helpful. TED Talks, I would love to get in on that.
Oh,
they
you
some
no, come
really
on.
Interesting.
You got to get an invite to go to TED.
I know. I'm really just fantasizing
here. $1,000.
I know.
I could see you one day giving a TED Talk.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, a couple of weeks ago, I watched this movie. It's related to Mike Emlett and his research interests. I watched this movie Limitless with Brad Cooper. I know you haven't seen it yet. But
I did see the previews. That looks really interesting.
Huh. Right. And so the premise of the, you know, I watched it and I have a couple movies I've been watching recently and some documentaries that I think have been raising some interesting questions. And I wouldn't mind, you know, just bringing them up. Maybe people be interested to watch the movies and just think about them. I just want to throw some ideas out there. I thought they were kind of fun. One of the big questions nowadays, probably in the last 5 years, is a question of ethics and medication, particularly designer drugs and you know, performance enhancing drugs we talk about with sports. But there's also cognitive enhancing drugs, I guess, for better lack of better word, nootropics, you know, new from noose. So there are, you know, a class of medication that can help you to think better, to think more clearly, or even medication like Provigil or something that you can take to help regulate your sleep. A lot of shift workers take that, people in security, you know, nurses, doctors, people that have goofy hours. But Limitless was a movie premised on this idea that Brad Cooper is a writer and he's struggling. He's not productive, you know, can't pay his rent. He has a book contract. I don't know how he got one, but he has a book contract and he's not producing. And he's struggling along and he comes into some underground drug. I won't spoil the whole thing. Like, this is basic plot of the movie, so it's not spoiling anything. And the premise of the movie is this drug allows him supposedly to use 100% of his brain. So he can remember everything, things, he's making connections. He's just basically supercharged his mind. Not that he has become supernatural or that he's become other human. It's just he has full access to everything that's there, memories and the power, the cognitive power of his mind. Cool. So with this new power, you know, everything looks bright. You know, everything is really nice in his life. He gets his act together. He cleans up and he finishes his book in a couple days, you know, and he ends up going on to, you know, work on a hedge fund or do some finance and he becomes a superstar on Wall Street. The questions that arise in this movie are, I think, interesting. When we can look at somebody like Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, and it's easy for the culture to criticize somebody for taking performance-enhancing drugs and to get upset and say, hey, we got to put an asterisk next to your record. You know, I can't believe you did this. You're a cheat. But what if there's a very affordable drug or if your employer says, hey, we're going to make this freely available to you so that you can concentrate better at work? It gets a little more gray when it's actually a tangible instance for an everyday person. You know, I don't think a lot of people aren't too many people tempted to take human growth hormone or steroids, just average people who work at a computer. You know, but if you could take a medication that was prescribed, let's say it's even legal, and next thing you know, you can concentrate, you can work better, you can get a lot of work done. Your life's better now, whatever. What are the ethics of that? You know, is that the same as a performance enhancing drug or is it something different? Is it okay? Is it within the bounds of Christian liberty or is it stepping across the bounds and, not an ethical thing to do. So yes. I don't have answers to all those. And I want to talk to Mike Emlett about this. I've been speaking with him. We're going to try to work something out in the new year to him about some of these issues. But it's a really profound question, I think.
It is. Well, when you think about there's not a lot of difference in philosophy between just coffee drinking. I mean, I'm drinking coffee right now. The only difference really is just in the intensity of what you're taking. And so, I mean, I drink coffee partially because it does wake me up and gives me a little bit of clarity that I otherwise wouldn't have. I don't think I'm addicted to it, but I certainly drink it a lot. So
it's a good question.
It's a gray area. So where the jump is in intensity and what you're actually taking, I can't see.
And if you're mastered by it.
Yeah, very true.
You know, part
of
the danger of this fake drug in the movie is, you know, you become hooked on it and you have the effect and you can't live without it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Mike is going to hit on heart issues there. And so that is completely crucial to this whole discussion, even with a thing like coffee. I mean, if you're really dependent on it to do a lot of things and you get out of sorts, you know, not drinking or whatever the case is, that's going to be a problem.
Give me my coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. If you're crabby to your wife or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Heart issues are definitely a thing there. And there are other questions with other drugs. We talk about alcohol. Is it permissible? And, you know, and there are a lot of different opinions on that. Alcohol is a drug or a substance that can also impair your thought, impair your behavior. So not only is it giving you some sort of effect, but it also inhibits you from honoring and glorifying God in your body.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe a little bit different from a cognitive drug where it's helping you to perform, but not inhibiting you unless there's a eventual crash.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So there's some other issues there too. It's just, I don't have any answer or really any direction to go with it. I just wanted to present the idea. And would encourage if anyone's interested in watching the movie, you know, watch it and think about it.
Yeah.
We'll have a show on it in the future. The issues.
That's what the CCF conference topic is.
Yeah, exactly. That's related.
Yeah, prescription medication. And Pallison makes the point, you know, even allergies can affect the way we behave and the way we think and just our body chemistry and how that manifests in behavior. And, you know, someone with severe allergies then has to make the choice. Okay, do I let the allergies affect it, or do I take something like Claritin that's going to change my behavior, maybe get rid of the allergies, but either make me drowsy or hyperactive or whatever the other symptoms are. And so
there's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
And something as mundane as an allergy medication, we don't often think about the theological implications of Claritin. But
yeah.
But
Claritin theology.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a fun movie. Another one I just watched yesterday with my father-in-law was on Netflix streaming. So if anyone has Netflix, you can go online and just, you know, hit play. It's called Exit Through the Gift Shop.
I have that in my queue.
Yeah.
I need to watch it. I haven't yet.
It was fun. It's an art documentary, and it raises the question about originality and what is art and what is the value of art. I don't know if it began. I don't think it started out as a movie trying to ask those questions. But it became that. What happened was there was a surge in what's called street art. You think about some of these famous artists like Banksy and Space Invader and some others. What they were doing is they came up with their own style and they were doing artwork on the street. So it's actually aesthetic, interesting, and messageful graffiti.
Uh-huh.
So it's illegal. But, you know, but they also do stuff in galleries now, too, because they've
there's
a demand. Right. But what these guys would do is under the guise of night, you know, they would in secrecy go and stencil something, or they would paste images. One guy's big thing was he had this picture of Andre the Giant. It said, "Obey."
I've seen
that. They would paste that everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the idea was he's advocating or propagating a message. It's propaganda, but that's part of his art, that he's making a statement about the government and authority as he posts this all over the place. Now, it's illegal because he's posting it, but that's part of the art. Now, you know, so we don't – don't agree with the way they go about it, mm-hmm. but it's interesting.
It is, yeah.
And Banksy did a lot of this. He does a lot of like rats, you know, stencils of rats. But I think you just go do a Google search for Banksy, you can see his website and see a lot of pictures of what he's done. Really interesting things. He even did a piece on the wall, not the Wailing Wall, but I believe in Israel, the wall that divides the banks, the East and West Bank, I believe.
Hmm.
I might be mistaken, but it's not the Wailing Wall, but another sure. significant wall in Israel.
It's called the Western Wall these days, by the way.
Oh, the Wailing Wall?
Since Israel is now a country, they have it's changed from Wailing to Western Wall.
Well, thank you for that correction.
Yeah, no problem. I'm sure there's a documentary on that as well.
I need some, I'm not a dispensationalist. My Israel modern day Israel history is not as good as it should be.
I lived in Jerusalem. That's pretty much the only reason I knew that.
Well, anyway, he did a stencil and a painting on the wall in the daytime. You know, there he had a lookout looking for, police officers, and he painted these little Israelite children that had broken a hole through the wall, and there was this like beach and palm tree scene.
Whoa.
Through the hole. So it was an optical illusion, but you look at it and you see these two kids with hammers and they, you know, busted a hole in the wall, and then you see a, you know, beach on the other side.
Wow.
So little stuff like that he would do. He also did something where he had he created an effigy. He dressed him up like Guantanamo Bay prisoners, and he hung one at one of the train rides at Disneyland. He put it in the cacti. And so it's sitting there, you know, he's handcuffed just like the Guantanamo Bay scene.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, it's pretty shocking statements, but he's making a statement, you know, about all this. You're in the amusement park having a good time, but then your government's doing this kind of stuff, you know. So he's making statements, though he's breaking the law to do them, but that's part of his shtick. So the documentary follows a guy that ended up documenting all of these different famous street artists. He would follow them around and record everything. He was their inside guy. And he would record, and it was under the premise that he was making a documentary. Well, he never got around to making a documentary. He had this compulsive nature that he just needed to film everything. So he had a house full of videotapes and didn't really do anything with them. But he eventually, the filmer, eventually comes to do his own art. And then the questions start coming up. Yeah. Where he copies a lot of other people, and there's questions as to the validity of what he's doing. Is he really doing art? Is he just copying others? And he ends up having a big art show and selling, you know, $1 million worth of stuff.
Whoa.
But it's worth watching because it brings up the question of what is the value of art? Where does its value come from? Is the value simply in how much it could be sold for? I think it ended up being an implicit criticism against the art community, maybe demonstrated a failure in the way it works. Not that it always fails, but in this case, it seemed to fail that somebody who's not really doing anything of value ended up, because he ended up being in the right place at the right time and having the right connections, creating a persona for himself. And ended up promoting his show and selling his work, even though it really wasn't worth buying.
Wow!
So that's the movie Exit that's Through the Gift Shop.
Yeah,
it was one of those where it was recommending it to me for several months, and I was thinking, why do I want to watch this? But I finally just said, okay, it's been on my queue forever. I'll hit play. Uh-huh. Really liked it.
That's
so
cool.
I think it's worth watching. And you know, we always, you know, in conversation, we've had a few episodes on Reform Forum where we've talked about art, and I just don't understand. It's such a difficult subject because we can ask the question, what is art? And man, just that simple of a question is really hard to answer.
It is. Yeah, completely. Yeah. And the value question is,
what is the really value?
Even more difficult.
Exactly.
Yeah, completely. Because the markets are so different. I mean, when you talk about something that's functional or just like a product out there, it's not art as art. It has a certain cost involved. And so, you know, you just say, okay, well, the market's going to determine the price. You know, that's a little bit above cost or whatever, but in terms of art, it's like, you know, what's the cost? Some paint or, you know, the cost of the marble or something. That's not what you're getting at. You know, it's what will people pay for something like that?
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you can boil it down to that. There's so many elements in it. Yeah.
It really is amazing. I watched another documentary about the Vogels, who are this elderly couple in New York that also became one of the foremost collectors of minimalist art and some pop art as well. And they just basically loved it. And every day they would go to a gallery or talk to artists, and they would buy many of these pieces before the artists were well known.
Hmm.
And today they've amassed just an enormous collection, and they donated it to the National Gallery.
Hmm.
But the gallery couldn't absorb the entire collection, so they've split the collection up into other collections, and they're giving pieces to museums in every state. So that's another one that talks about the value of art and collecting, even on a post officer's budget. This guy's
wow.
a mailman. You know,
that's
his wife was a librarian, and they amassed one of the world's greatest minimalist things. But then you have, you know, a rope, a little piece of a rope nailed to a wall, and that's like a very valuable piece. And so, you know, they're interviewed, and one of the interviewers says, "Now, what is this? Like, what does this mean?" And uh-huh. she's like, "Does it have to mean anything?" You know? And so,
well, and we've talked about this before, but oftentimes you get, it's almost just intuition drives the value or even the lack of meaning or the meaning in uh-huh. art. And so when you press an artist on it, a lot of times it's not this carefully considered, well, here's the exact meaning that I'm going for. It's just, you know, we demand that kind of precision. You and I mean, and people in our circles demand that kind of precision because we're used to it in maybe like the academic fields. But when you actually talk to artists, there's so much more than just, here's my plan, here's
yeah.
the execution.
The logic doesn't really apply.
No. And so yeah. to try to nail it, it really is trying to, you know, nail jello to a wall, because there are so many non-logical elements involved in creating art that it's just less precise.
I think a lot of it also, what becomes popular and what is successful, it's almost like sometimes that's just how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you can go read a lot of the, you know, popular Christian blogs. There are so many good ones that might have 5 readers or something like that.
True.
And sometimes I'm left wondering, why does blog A become super popular and becomes
know.
A de facto site? But blog B, which in my opinion, which is just one person's opinion, is so much more substantive and thoughtful and interesting. But the crowd goes towards another. I wonder why that is. And I've thought it would be interesting for a church historian, maybe this probably isn't a PhD thing, but maybe a THM thesis or an MA thesis somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Or a journal to do, article.
Yeah, a journal article to do a history of you know, Reformed or a history of conservative evangelical blogs, and try to understand from a cultural perspective why certain popular blogs became popular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, popularity isn't the measure of quality.
Mm-mm.
But I'm just curious. I just don't know how this happens.
Yeah, and we've had this conversation before, and I don't know if we want to get into blog chat. I'm fine with that. But yeah, the blogs and then the microblogs with tweeting.
Exactly. Also Twitter followers. Like, what are the dynamics of this?
It's a different world out there right now than it was even 5 years ago. Because I'm convinced that there is something to, and I hate to say this, I hate to actually admit this, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, but there is something to the amount of Twitter followers that someone has and the status and everything that's associated with that. And I'm saying this, I barely have any, and that's fine. But you kind of let the Twitter market decide who's going to be the most popular, because
whose voice is worth listening to.
Exactly.
Because, well, this guy has 10,000 followers.
Yeah.
He must have something important to say.
Yeah. And that's not always the case. But, and if you think about that, following someone is voluntary. And so when you see a guy who has like 20,000 followers, all those followers voluntarily say, I want to hear what this guy says.
Yes.
And it's the same with the normal blogs out there as well.
Yeah, web traffic, you know, readers. Yeah.
And I'm just, this is fun. I tweeted recently something like, you know, that just as in pop music, There will always be pop music, something that has just a basic musical structure. So simple, but that you can bop your head to.
I've
and it's
got
just
a
kind of
feeling.
Yeah. Black Eyed Peas are one good example.
And then you got the Jeff Tweedies who make fun of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Who make fun of the pop music.
And then you have like the, I mean, Mumford & Sons is a bad example because they're very popular, but something that, like a Ray LaMontagne or something where it's not as just kind of pop candy music. It's music that you sit with and you let settle and everything. It's a little bit more substantial.
Once in a while, he might have, you know, Trouble or something,
right?
Which the song Trouble, and then it takes off within a certain market.
Yeah,
but it's not a Lady Gaga type.
No,
you know,
yeah, Just Dance or something like that. But I love this discussion because I cannot figure out why it, just as you said, something is more popular than another. And I do think that there is a culture out there in the blog and the microblog world that is just satisfied with this theological candy. And these short, pithy phrases or kind of generic blogs out there. And we've talked about this where if you have these theological Mad Lib terms like the gospel or
it's like Christian contemporary music.
Yeah, yeah. If you have these like buzzwords, then you're covered and it's going to be popular. And you just kind of manipulate these theological buzzwords when – I don't know. I know that I'm the exception, but I'm really looking for something more substantial than a tweet or a blog that says, well, something that's been established is not this, it's really this. And that's a constant pattern in the tweet world. Like, faith is not just X, Y, and Z. Faith is really Z, Y, and X. You know, it's just great. I'm really not fed by that. Yeah, but people, you know, it has like this clever ring to it, and so it gets some traffic.
Yeah, Twitterist.
But it's hard for me to figure out what's the need out there that people are speaking to.
You know, and it's easy to be the little guy, you and I, and to be grumps like Waldorf and I forget the other guy's name, the Muppet, the old man Muppets that sit up in the balcony.
In the balcony, yeah.
You know,
I don't want to be that at all.
Sometimes we feel a little bit like
that. I don't think I am.
You know, and there's also something to be said about, well, you know, a popular blogger or a popular tweeter might starts tweeting those things, and then there's a gravitation towards it, and it can become the norm because there's a network effect, and it can be an echo chamber. And so you see a popular guy tweeting tweets like that, and you think, okay, it's his correlation causation. Well, that must be how he got popular. Right, so then other people do it, right. You know, and it's a dangerous place because you fight for Twitter followers, and it's almost too bad that they publish them, because then we you know, you can measure somebody's value based on how many followers they have.
I know.
And John Piper's talked about this, and it's super dangerous. It's a super self-conceited pride fuel, you know, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, because it's an empirical measuring stick. It really is. I mean, there is a numerical, quote-unquote,
with
value.
With a blog, you don't per se have access to somebody's web stats. But with Twitter, there it is. You can look it up.
Yeah, you know, it's exactly right there. Yeah. That's true. I mean, with blogs, it's you get this, again, kind of this intuitive feeling of, okay, I've seen this article linked 5 times on my Facebook page.
You get a sense. But we can't go and say, you know, Kevin DeYoung's blog versus, Justin Taylor, and get an empirical number and say – so-and-so has this many more readers.
Right, true.
But we get a sense that they're both very significant, and I want to clear the record. I think both write good things and are of value to read.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to lump them in with the vague discussion we're talking about with Twitter and whatnot. I think they're some of the better ones. But, you know, so it's just odd, network effects. And I think it'd be a really interesting research and of value. And traditionally, you know, church history and historians aren't likely to do anything, you know, sooner, more recent than 20 years. But this is internet world. And, you know, a 10-year study on the internet trends, I think, could be of some value.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even with us at Reform Forum, it's interesting to see what episodes get commented on and what don't. And you do see somewhat
I can look at the download numbers, too.
Yeah, download numbers,
you started to learn a little bit. I've started to learn a little bit of how these things get passed along.
Yeah.
When you start to see topics, people, and then who linked to it, there's very tangible differences, a very measurable, I should say, measurable differences. when those three factors are played. And for us, it could be easy and tempting to say, well, okay, well, let's start to schedule guests and to schedule topics that are going to strike that pattern.
Right, right, right.
Okay, what is a topic that, one, we got to get a guy in, one of, you know, he's got a lot of Twitter followers or something,
yeah,
their blog. Two, we have to do a topic that's a hot topic. And mm-hmm. three, we need to make sure that it's going to ring true to somebody else, another popular blogger who would be willing to promote it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, we try not to do that. I mean, once in a while, we're going to do that because we do want to serve the needs of the listeners and allow them to listen to something significant and mm-hmm. timely and that's going to speak to what's going on out there.
Yeah, speaking to found theology.
Yeah, but at the same time, we'll interview just somebody who nobody's heard of. We'll bring in our buddy Carlton, and we'll talk about Van Til's Trinitarian Theology because we took a class together.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's not going to get tweeted by a real high-profile Christian tweeter.
I know. Carlton's on Twitter, and he never tweets. he's not going to be promoting his own episode. Well, and you know,
but we think it's a value, and we know there are people out there that would listen, and, you know, it's a push model.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like, okay. We run this site. We want to talk about this. We think it's important. There it is. If you want to listen, listen.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that arrogant? Is that?
No. I know what you mean. I think one of the things that gets me jazzed, and this happens organically, so you can't really force it, but I love to see when different spheres interact with each other. And I'll give you one example. I mean, John Piper interacting with a guy like Lecrae, who's a hip hop rap artist. Mm-hmm. Those are two spheres and two. Two individuals who have very, very, well, somewhat different followers. Let's put it that way. They come from two different worlds. And when they interact on Twitter, it is a cool thing to see. And one thing that just happened.
Well, they're bringing two worlds together because
exactly.
All the followers get all the.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's
the responses from
the
other guy.
There's crosstalk going on that I think is constructive and good. And I think in the broader church community should happen a little bit more. One example that I saw just recently, I know I'm such a nerd on this that I even follow these kinds of things, but Rick Warren, who has almost 500,000 followers, I don't know who even approaches him. John Piper has a lot, but anyway, Burke Parsons, who is, if you don't follow Burke, you should. Burke has some great, great things to say.
Burke's
out there.
A fun guy.
Yeah, he great guy. I follow him. I definitely enjoy what he has to say. And so I saw he tweeted something, and it was actually about polemics, and it was well put. And then Rick Warren responded to that. I didn't even know Rick followed Burke. That's a very cool thing.
I think Rick Warren follows Reform Forum.
He follows Westminster too.
Awesome.
He follows Westminster Seminary. I mean, I think he follows probably about 500,000 too. So who knows how he's getting his information. But
click,
he responded to something that Burke said. Now Burke has a lot too. But when you compare something like, you know, 6,000 to 500,000, that's a substantial jump. And to see these two people who are in pastoral ministry interact on this level is a good thing, I think. Both of those guys I have respect for, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of like status associated with the number of followers. They're doing good things out there by promoting the gospel in this manner. So to see those two worlds come together, I think was just an interesting thing to say the least, and I'd love to see that happen.
You know, you mentioned polemics, and that's another thing that comes up. You were just talking about this before we started recording. There's a lot going on, and what do you have to say for the present state of polemics, particularly as it relates to this whole culture we're talking about, the Twitter culture, the blog culture, and everything? Whatever happened to eclectic theology?
I know. I think there seems to be a formula happening out there where you have a discussion going on that has the potential to be discussed in length, into great detail out there, let's go in the blog world, wherever it is. And then you have another figure who sees the other side of whatever the discussion is, and so they start interacting. Inevitably, what happens is you get a person coming along who's like a pastoral type or someone who wants to say, hey guys, what we really need to remember is Christian charity in this. Meanwhile, there's Christian Charity is going on. All they're doing is having a discussion.
Yeah, nobody's insulting anybody.
No one's insulting. Name calling. All it is a theological discussion disagreement. And you can say, I disagree with you. And I really think that this is important for the gospel, that this be precise, that this be discussed in a way where we do come to some kinds of conclusions that have ministry implications. But inevitably what happens is you have a huge constituency who says, yeah, you know what? That's right. We do need to remember Christian Charity, and we do need to, and all that is true, but it may not be relevant because if you can't point to specific things that are said, maybe that doesn't need to be said because it often acts as a red herring to the actual discussion.
Yeah. I think a lot of times it downplays the significance of the discussion and it can level it.
Yeah.
And subsume it under what you end up doing is just prizing theological similarity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, we're brothers in Christ, of course. We worship the same God. We welcome each other into each other's churches, and conferences and whatever. But also, we can have a significant theological disagreement, and it can be left at that. Mm-hmm. And we can discuss, we can present our cases, we can write journal articles,
and we can produce resources. We
can be passionate about it, provided we're all doing it, as brothers in Christ, and, mm-hmm. Name calling, insults. Nobody's getting upset or mm-hmm. doing anything out of anger, which isn't happening most of the time. There doesn't have to be a third party to come in and remind everybody, now, guys, we're all brothers here. Yes, we know. But whatever happened to, like you said, eclectic theology?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If Van Til can come in and criticize Kuyper and Warfield, Machen or whoever, does another colleague need to come in and say, oh, remember, Van Til likes this part of Kuyper.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's like, okay, you can read his other books. Does that have to be said?
Yeah. It's just
It takes the focus off the actual important thing at the moment, which is the discussion, the debate.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost tries to move that and put it off to the side and say, well, for those people who really want to dive into it, you can look into that. But let's just remember that we're all presenting a united front here.
Mm-hmm.
And it tries to recenter the discussion so that we focus on the unity, which is always there,
mm-hmm.
at the expense of clarity sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I think I don't always think that's intended, but often what we have is by not wanting polemical theology, eclectic theology, that's an old term for it, we end up with prizing unity at the expense of theological precision and clarity sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And of course, I mean, both of us recognize that there's a scale in terms of importance of what's being discussed. So if you're discussing something like the size of a communion cup and having a disagreement on whether it should be this size or that size, that's not going to be central to the gospel. But if you are discussing something like the recent talks on sanctification, I hope every person involved in that discussion is very passionate about what they're discussing and makes a strong, precise case for it without having to worry about people coming in and saying, guys, this has been a discussion that's been going on a long time. We've discussed this before. It doesn't, let's just talk about or focus on how we're united in certain other fronts. That doesn't need to be said if something specific isn't going on with name calling or insulting or something like that.
Yeah.
So I just, that pattern seems to be something that keeps coming up when discussion happens.
There is not always a valid via media. Another thing. We presume there has to be some middle ground, and we often value that as trying to take the best of both worlds. That also is a logical fallacy we can come into,
mm-hmm.
that if there are two opposing parties, it doesn't mean that the truth must necessarily be in between them both.
That's right.
One guy can be right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or one position can be right. They can both be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And terribly wrong. Mm. And there is no via media between two terribly wrong things necessarily.
Yeah.
And so this is all part, and we've lost a lot of this. We lost a lot of this with scholasticism.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of the everyday education process in scholastic thought. You'd have one guy who would present his case, his question. You'd have a disputation. Somebody would present, their issues with it. And then they would, with their students, work out the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Turretin wrote. That's how Aquinas wrote. It's just a scholastic pedagogical method that is just inherent. That's why Turretin's book's called Principles or
Institutes
of Eclectic Theology. Yeah. Well, it's eclectic because he's criticizing and comparing his opponents, but he's also doing it in the scholastic method that is asking questions.
We affirm or we deny.
A proposition, a response, and then a solution. And it's not like he comes in and says, the Reformed tradition says this, the Socinians say this, well, I'm coming in, let me fix this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you'll say, no, man, the Socinians are wrong.
I know, exactly, yeah.
And that can be of value, and mm-hmm. that's a God-honoring thing to do, provided it's done with charity and with love, even towards those whom we might think are heretical.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. I recently had a discussion with a guy who is not in the Reformed tradition, has recently been exposed to Van Til. And so he's trying to, okay, what is Van Til getting at here? And comes from an evidentialist background.
Yeah.
And I had a long conversation with him, and he was saying that the conversations that he's had with supporters of Van Til, he's been shocked at how arrogant they can come across, and just overly confident and putting a lot of stock in themselves and their own Van Tilian argument rather than pointing people to scripture, all those kinds of things. I think that they're this is the counter to what we're saying. I think there's some truth to that, that a lot of times people in the Reformed community and in the Van Til community can come across that way and can be overly confident and somewhat arrogant in their reliance on Van Til to almost like do the work for them in, mm-hmm. in apologetic arguments. Mm-hmm. That's one thing going on. Another thing is, I think it's tough to articulate Van Til in a way to this culture that doesn't come across as arrogant if you say, I think this is true and this other thing is not true, because even that disagreement is going to come across as arrogant in this culture. So there's a balance there in disposition in arguing.
Yeah, and then suaviter in modo.
Yeah.
I always try to tell that to Jonathan because he does that, but I tease him.
I know.
He gets fired up at his house sometimes when we have discussions. I go, Jonathan, suaviter in modo.
Yeah, he just loves that. That's what you want to tell somebody in the moment. So all that is to say, I think there are two things going on. There's a culture right now that does not like polemics and really bristles at the thought and tries to shy away and tries to get at some kind of middle way, often unsuccessfully.
Yeah.
And then there's also, we need to be reflective on ourselves and say, am I really being arrogant in what I'm saying? And does what I'm saying, can I say it better in a way that leaves no room for the charge of arrogance?
Hey, let's wrap this up. But here's a philosophical discussion or a philosophical cap to this. Isn't it kind of just Hegelian?
Oh, yeah, right. Thesis, antithesis, and then I come along with my synthesis. That's a good point.
Things don't always work like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's completely true. Yeah.
Would Hegel ever say, here's the thesis, the antithesis, and the thesis one?
Uh-huh.
You know?
No. Yeah, yeah, that's completely true. Yeah, and I mean, polemics talking about in the abstract may or may not be helpful, but I think what I would love to see out there is just a recognition that it's okay to discuss these things. It's okay to just discuss these things passionately.
We're
adults. We can honor the brother while still saying, look, I think you're dead wrong. I think what you're saying is not a good articulation of the gospel. If we value the gospel as much as everybody says we should out there in the blog land and the Twitter world, then we should be very, very passionate about anything that even is
a
whisper against
it. There's a place for this. Look, and I think blogs and Twitter are a great place for theological discussion. Mm-hmm. But in the worship setting, people say, well, we have to be united on these things. Well, I think there's a context for that as well. We do that in the worship service.
Mm-hmm.
It is a great context for that. It would be totally inappropriate for me to speak out during a hymn and say some problem I have with the wording of something in the hymn.
True.
Or to criticize the pastor while he's preaching would be outrageous, you know, because we're united. You know, we're worshiping together. You can have issues here and there, but you deal with, that's not the context for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, likewise, blogs, I think, are very helpful opportunities and places for discussion to happen. And it doesn't always have to be that united front, you know, that there can be real disagreement, and it can be left at that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Yeah. Some food for thought for today, you know, issues in contemporary evangelicalism.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, if you're going to talk about theology, just expect to have people disagree with you, and that's okay. That's really okay. I think the manner is important, but it's just going to happen.
And we need to be, you know, get back to the heart issues. We always have to be doing things for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And whenever we get criticized as well, we shouldn't always take it personally and be offended, because we can do that too.
Very
misunderstand.
True. Yeah.
So this has been fun. Off the beaten track, I think, the beaten path for our typical episodes, but of value nonetheless. I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming over to the studio again, Jared. It's good to have you here.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Thanks, Camden.
Yeah, I want to point everybody to our website. So I guess I'll let Jared promote the Westminster stuff first, because I'll inevitably get something wrong. So where can people find you and Westminster?
The best place to go is just wts.edu, and you'll mm-hmm. see to the right we have linked our Facebook page and our Twitter page, our YouTube page, and then iTunes U. I can't hit that enough, because there's a lot of just free courses out there, and I just
get free. You want free seminary education? You're not going to get a degree, but just go to iTunes U and download the courses.
Yeah,
listen I've been to listening them in the car when you're on the treadmill, whatever, running, whatever.
Yeah, I've been recently listening to Dr. Gaffin's Theology of Hebrews course. Like anything else Gaffin does, it's methodical, and so you really do have to pay attention, but some of that stuff in there, or a lot of that stuff in there, is just crucial to understanding the book.
I'm listening to his course on Romans
right now. Nice. Excellent.
And then I'm going back to ST101. I checked that from the library. I don't know if that's on iTunes U, but I checked it out from the library.
It's not, but that's good.
Anyway, so that's great. And you know, speaking of Twitter, where can people follow you on Twitter?
Follow me.
Jared Oliphant?
Yeah, Jared Oliphant. You can just, I'm on there.
Reformed Forum is available, of course, at reformedforum.org. We have links to all of our websites. And please sign up for the mailing list. If you go to the homepage there's an email mailing list. And we don't bomb you with mail. We're just sending, at the moment, just one a month. And we want to be connected to you. And it's another way that we can communicate with you in a way that we can actually get to you. Because we try to tweet these things, but the way Twitter works, of course, you're not going to see everything. And so we really want to be able to get our monthly newsletter to you, especially in the future, as some very interesting new projects come out that we're working on right now. We really would like you to hear about them. And the way we do our recordings and stuff, sometimes it's out of sync. So it's not in line with what's going on in the world when it's released, because we have to record in advance sometimes because of our schedules. So please, I encourage you, go to reformedforum.org. Right on the homepage, there's a place where you can type in your email address. We won't spam you. Of course, you can unsubscribe whenever you want. Subscribe to the email newsletter. I also want to mention that Reformed Forum is now a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We've been mentioning this in recent episodes. So we would very much encourage you to visit us at our donation page. Reformforum.org has a big donate now button at the top of the page. Visit right now and donate today. Help us to continue to produce and distribute all of these services and resources for free. And we're growing. We've got a lot of great things. I can't announce them yet, but we're working on some really great stuff, and we need your support. So visit us online and donate now, and also continue to pray for us, that we would continue to grow and continue to be a help for the church, supporting her in every possible way we can, because we have a heart for presenting every man mature in Christ, Colossians 1:28. But the only real way to do that is the church does that, and we can help the church out wherever possible. So visit us online there, reformforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.